Now let's say you finished your first draft. Congratulations. Good job. Have a glass of champagne. Send out for a pizza. Do whatever it is you do when you've got something to celebrate. If you have someone who has been impatiently waiting to read your novel, a spouse, let's say, someone who has perhaps been working 9 to 5 and helping to pay the bills while you chase your dream, then this is the time to give up the goods. If, that is, your first reader or readers will promise not to talk to you about the book until you are ready to talk to them about it. This may sound a little high-handed, but it's really not. You've done a lot of work, and you need a period of time, how much or how little depends on the individual writer, to rest. Your mind and imagination, two things which are related but not really the same, have to recycle themselves, at least in regard to this one particular work. My advice is that you take a couple of days off, go fishing, go kayaking, do a jigsaw puzzle, and then go to work on something else, something shorter, preferably, and something that's a complete change of direction and pace from your newly finished book. I wrote some pretty good novellas, The Body and Apt Pupil among them, between drafts of longer works like The Dead Zone and The Dark Half. How long you'll let your book rest, sort of like bread dough between kneadings, is entirely up to you, but I think it should be a minimum of 6 weeks. During this time, your manuscript will be safely shut away in a desk drawer, aging and, one hopes, mellowing. Your thoughts will turn to it frequently, and you'll likely be tempted a dozen times or more to take it out, if only to reread some passage that seems particularly fine in your memory, something you'd like to go back to so you can re-experience what a really exciting writer you are. Resist temptation. If you don't, you'll very likely decide you didn't do as well on that passage as you thought, and you'd better retool it on the spot. This is bad. The only thing worse would be for you to decide the passage is even better than you remembered. Why not drop everything and read the whole book over right then? Get back to work on it. Hell, you're ready. You're fucking Shakespeare. You're not, though. And you're not ready to go back to the old project until you've gotten so involved in a new one, or re-involved in your day-to-day life, that you've almost forgotten the unreal estate that took up 3 hours of your every morning or afternoon for a period of 3 or 5 or 7 months. When you come to the correct evening, which you may well have marked on your office calendar, take your manuscript out of the drawer. If it looks like an alien relic, bought at a junk shop or a yard sale where you can hardly remember stopping, you're ready. Sit down with your door shut. You'll be opening it to the world soon enough. A pencil in your hand and a legal pad by your side. Then, read your manuscript over. Do it all in one sitting, if that's possible. It won't be, of course, if your book is a 400 or 500-pager. Make all the notes you want, but concentrate on the mundane housekeeping jobs, like fixing misspellings and picking up inconsistencies. There'll be plenty. Only God gets it right the first time, and only a slob says, oh well, let it go. That's what copy editors are for. If you've never done it before, you'll find reading your book over after a 6-week layoff to be a strange, often exhilarating experience. It's yours. You'll recognize it as yours, even be able to remember what tune was on the stereo when you wrote certain lines. And yet, it will also be like reading the work of someone else, a soul twin, perhaps. This is the way it should be, the reason you waited. It's always easier to kill someone else's darlings than it is to kill your own. With 6 weeks' worth of recuperation time, you'll also be able to see any glaring holes in the plot or character development. I'm talking about holes big enough to drive a truck through. It's amazing how some of these things can elude the writer while he or she is occupied with the daily work of composition. And listen, if you spot a few of these big holes, you are forbidden to feel depressed about them or to beat up on yourself. Screw-ups happen to the best of us. There's a story that the architect of the Flatiron Building committed suicide when he realized just before the ribbon-cutting ceremony that he had neglected to put any men's rooms in his prototypical skyscraper. Probably not true, but remember this, someone really did design the Titanic and then label it unsinkable. For me, The most glaring errors I find on the reread have to do with character motivation, related to character development, but not quite the same. I'll smack myself upside the head with the heel of my palm, then grab my legal pad and write something like, Page 91, Sandy Hunter filches a buck from Shirley's stash in the dispatch office. Why? God's sake, Sandy would never do anything like this. I also mark the page in the manuscript with a big cross-out symbol, meaning that cuts and or changes are needed on this page, and reminding myself to check my notes for the exact details if I don't remember them. I love this part of the process. Well, I love all parts of the process, but this one is especially nice, because I'm rediscovering my own book and usually liking it. That changes. By the time a book is actually in print, I've been over it a dozen times or more, can quote whole passages, and only wish the damned old smelly thing would go away. That's later, though. The first read-through is usually pretty fine. During that reading, the top part of my mind is concentrating on story and toolbox concerns, knocking out pronouns with unclear antecedents. I hate and mistrust pronouns, every one of them as slippery as a fly-by-night personal injury lawyer. Adding clarifying phrases where they seem necessary, and, of course, deleting all the adverbs I can bear to part with. Never all of them, never enough. Underneath, however, I'm asking myself the big questions. The biggest, is this story coherent? And if it is, what will turn coherence into a song? What are the recurring elements? Do they entwine and make a theme? I'm asking myself, what's it all about, Stevie, in other words, and what I can do to make those underlying concerns even clearer. What I want most of all is resonance, something that will linger for a little while in constant reader's mind and heart after he or she has closed the book and put it up on the shelf. I'm looking for ways to do that without spoon-feeding the reader or selling my birthright for a plot of message. Take all those messages and those morals and stick 'em where the sun don't shine, all right? I want resonance. Most of all, I'm looking for what I meant, because in the second draft I'll want to add scenes and incidents that reinforce that meaning. I'll also want to delete stuff that goes in other directions. There's apt to be a lot of that stuff, especially near the beginning of a story when I have a tendency to flail. All that thrashing around has to go if I am to achieve anything like a unified effect. When I've finished reading and making all my little anal retentive revisions, it's time to open the door and show what I've written to four or five close friends who have indicated a willingness to look. Someone, I can't remember who for the life of me, once wrote that all novels are really letters aimed at one person. As it happens, I believe this. I think that every novelist has a single ideal reader. That at various points during the composition of a story, the writer is thinking, I wonder what he or she will think when he or she reads this part. For me, that first reader is my wife, Tabitha. She has always been an extremely sympathetic and supportive first reader. Her positive reaction to difficult books like Bag of Bones, my first novel with a new publisher after 20 good years with Viking, that came to an end in a stupid squabble about money, and relatively controversial ones like Gerald's Game, meant the world to me. But she's also unflinching when she sees something she thinks is wrong. When she does, she lets me know loud and clear. In her role as critic and first reader, Tabby often makes me think of a story I read about Alfred Hitchcock's wife, Alma Reville. Ms. Reville was the equivalent of Hitch's first reader, a sharp-eyed critic who was totally unimpressed with the suspense master's growing reputation as an auteur. Lucky for him, Hitch say he want to fly. Alma say, first, eat your eggs. Not long after finishing Psycho, Hitchcock screened it for a few friends. They raved about it, declaring it to be a suspense masterpiece. Alma was quiet until they'd all had their say, then spoke very firmly. You can't send it out like that. There was a thunderstruck silence, except for Hitchcock himself, who only asked why not. Because, his wife responded, Janet Lee swallows when she's supposed to be dead. It was true. Hitchcock didn't argue any more than I do when Tabby points out one of my lapses. She and I may argue about many aspects of a book, and there have been times when I've gone against her judgment on subjective matters, but when she catches me in a goof, I know it, and thank God I've got someone around who'll tell me my fly's unzipped before I go out in public that way. In addition to Tabby's first read, I usually send manuscripts to between 4 and 8 other people who have critiqued my stories over the years. Many writing texts caution against asking friends to read your stuff, suggesting you're not apt to get a very unbiased opinion from folks who've eaten dinner at your house and sent their kids over to play with your kids in your backyard. It's unfair, according to this view, to put a pal in such a position. What happens if he or she feels he or she has to say, "I'm sorry, good buddy, you've written some great yarns in the past, but this one sucks like a vacuum cleaner." The idea has some validity, but I don't think an unbiased opinion is exactly what I'm looking for. And I believe that most people smart enough to read a novel are also tactful enough to find a gentler mode of expression than "this sucks." Although most of us know that "I think this has a few problems" actually means "this sucks," don't we? Besides, if you really did write a stinker, it happens. As the author of Maximum Overdrive, I'm qualified to say so. Wouldn't you rather hear the news from a friend while the entire edition consists of 6 Xerox copies? When you give out 6 or 8 copies of a book, you get back 6 or 8 highly subjective opinions about what's good and what's bad in it. If all your readers think you did a pretty good job, you probably did. This sort of unanimity does happen, but it's rare, even with friends. More likely, they'll think that some parts are good and some parts are, well, not so good. Some will feel character A works, but character B is far-fetched. If others feel that character B is believable, but character A is overdrawn, it's a wash. You can safely relax and leave things the way they are. In baseball, tie goes to the runner. For novelists, it goes to the writer. If some people love your ending and others hate it, same deal. It's a wash, and tie goes to the writer. Some first readers specialize in pointing out factual errors, which are the easiest to deal with. One of my first reader smart guys, the late Mac McCutcheon, a wonderful high school English teacher, knew a lot about guns. If I had a character toting a Winchester 330, Mac might jot in the margin that Winchester didn't make that caliber, but Remington did. In such cases, you've got 2 for the price of 1, the error and the fix. It's a good deal because you come off looking like you're an expert, and your first reader will feel flattered to have been of help. And the best catch Mac ever made for me had nothing to do with guns. One day, while reading a piece of a manuscript in the teacher's room, he burst out laughing, laughed so hard, in fact, that tears went rolling down his bearded cheeks. Because the story in question, Salem's Lot, had not been intended as a laugh riot, I asked him what he had found. I had written a line that went something like this: "Although deer season doesn't start until November in Maine, the fields of October are often alive with gunshots. The locals are shooting as many peasants as they think their families will eat." A copy editor would no doubt have picked up the mistake, but Mac spared me that embarrassment. I had meant, of course, pheasants. Subjective evaluations are, as I say, a little harder to deal with. But listen, if everyone who reads your book says you have a problem — Connie comes back to her husband too easily, Hal's cheating on the big exam seems unrealistic given what we know about him, the novel's conclusion seems abrupt and arbitrary — you've got a problem, and you better do something about it. Plenty of writers resist this idea. They feel that revising a story according to the likes and dislikes of an audience is somehow akin to prostitution. If you really feel that way, I won't try to change your mind. You'll save on charges at CopyCop, too, because you won't have to show anyone your story in the first place. In fact, he said snottily, if you really feel that way, why bother to publish at all? Just finish your books and then pop them in a safe deposit box, as J.D. Salinger is reputed to have been doing in his later years. And yes, I can relate at least a bit to that sort of resentment. In the film business, where I have had a quasi-professional life, first draft showings are called test screenings. These have become standard practice in the industry, and they drive most filmmakers absolutely bugshit. Maybe they should. The studio shells out somewhere between $15 and $100 million to make a film, then asks the director to recut it based on the opinions of a Santa Barbara multiplex audience composed of hairdressers, meter maids, shoe store clerks, and out-of-work pizza delivery guys. And the worst, most maddening thing about it? If you get the demographic right, test screenings seem to work. I'd hate to see novels revised on the basis of test audiences. A lot of good books would never see the light of day if it was done that way. But come on, we're talking about half a dozen people you know and respect. If you ask the right ones, and if they agree to read your book, they can tell you a lot. Do all opinions weigh the same? Not for me. In the end, I listen most closely to Tabby because she's the one I write for, the one I want to wow. If you're writing primarily for one person besides yourself, I'd advise you to pay very close attention to that person's opinion. I know one fellow who says he writes mostly for someone who's been dead 15 years, but the majority of us aren't in that position. And if what you hear makes sense, then make the changes. You can't let the whole world into your story, but you can let in the ones that matter the most, and you should. Call that one person you write for ideal reader. He or she is going to be in your writing room all the time, in the flesh once you open the door and let the world back in to shine on the bubble of your dream, in spirit during the sometimes troubling and often exhilarating days of the first draft when the door is closed. And you know what? You'll find yourself bending the story even before ideal reader glimpses so much as the first sentence. IR will help you get outside yourself a little to actually read your work in progress as an audience would while you're still working. This is perhaps the best way of all to make sure you stick to story, a way of playing to the audience even while there's no audience there and you're totally in charge. When I write a scene that strikes me as funny, like the pie-eating contest in The Body or the execution rehearsal in The Green Mile, I am also imagining my IR finding it funny. I love it when Tabby laughs out of control. She puts her hands up as if to say, "I surrender," and these big tears go rolling down her cheeks. I love it, that's all. I fucking adore it. And when I get hold of something with that potential, I twist it as hard as I can. During the actual writing of such a scene, door closed, the thought of making her laugh or cry is in the back of my mind. During the rewrite, door open, the question, is it funny enough yet, scary enough, is right up front. I try to watch her when she gets to a particular scene, hoping for at least a smile or jackpot, baby, that big belly laugh with the hands up waving in the air. This isn't always easy on her. I gave her the manuscript of my novella, Hearts in Atlantis, while we were in North Carolina, where we'd gone to see a Cleveland Rockers Charlotte Sting WNBA game. We drove north to Virginia the following day, and it was during this drive that Tabby read my story. There are some funny parts in it, at least I thought so, and I kept peeking over at her to see if she was chuckling, or at least smiling. I didn't think she'd notice, but of course she did. On my 8th or 9th peak, I guess it could have been my 15th, she looked up and snapped, "Pay attention to your driving before you crack us up, will you? Stop being so goddamn needy." I paid attention to my driving and stopped sneaking peeks. Well, almost. About 5 minutes later, I heard a snort of laughter from my right. Just a little one, but it was enough for me. The truth is that most writers are needy, especially between the first draft and the second, when the study door swings open and the light of the world shines in. Ideal reader is also the best way for you to gauge whether or not your story is paced correctly and if you've handled the backstory in satisfactory fashion. Pace is the speed at which your narrative unfolds. There is a kind of unspoken, hence undefended and unexamined, belief in publishing circles that the most commercially successful stories and novels are fast-paced. I guess the underlying thought is that people have so many things to do today and are so easily distracted from the printed word that you'll lose them unless you become a kind of short-order cook, serving up sizzling burgers, fries, and eggs over easy just as fast as you can. Like so many unexamined beliefs in the publishing business, this idea is largely bullshit. Which is why, when books like Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose or Charles Frazier's Cold Mountain suddenly break out of the pack and climb the bestseller lists, publishers and editors are astonished. I suspect that most of them ascribe these books' unexpected success to unpredictable and deplorable lapses into good taste on the part of the reading public. Not that there's anything wrong with rapidly paced novels. Some pretty good writers, Nelson DeMille, Wilbur Smith, and Sue Grafton, to name just three, have made millions writing them. But you can overdo the speed thing. Move too fast and you risk leaving the reader behind, either by confusing or by wearing him or her out. And for myself, I like a slower pace and a bigger, higher build. The leisurely luxury liner experience of a long, absorbing novel like The Far Pavilions or A Suitable Boy has been one of the form's chief attractions since the first examples, endless, multi-part epistolary tales like Clarissa. I believe each story should be allowed to unfold at its own pace, and that pace is not always double time. Nevertheless, you need to beware. If you slow the pace down too much, even the most patient reader is apt to grow restive. The best way to find the happy medium? Ideal reader, of course. Try to imagine whether he or she will be bored by a certain scene. If you know the tastes of your IR even half as well as I know the tastes of mine, that shouldn't be too hard. Is IR going to feel this too much pointless talk in this place or that? That you've underexplained a certain situation, or overexplained it, which is one of my chronic failings? That you forgot to resolve some important plot point? Forgot an entire character, as Raymond Chandler once did? When asked about the murdered chauffeur in The Big Sleep, Chandler, who liked his tipple, replied, "Oh, him. You know, I forgot all about him." These questions should be in your mind even with the door closed. And once it's open, once your ideal reader has actually read your manuscript, you should ask your questions out loud. Also, needy or not, you might want to watch and see when your IR puts your manuscript down to do something else. What scene was he or she reading? What was so easy to put down? Mostly, when I think of pacing, I go back to Elmore Leonard, who explained it so perfectly by saying he just left out the boring parts. This suggests cutting to speed the pace, and that's what most of us end up having to do. Kill your darlings, even when it breaks your egocentric little scribbler's heart. Kill your darlings. As a teenager, sending out stories to magazines like Fantasy and Science Fiction and Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, I got used to the sort of rejection note that starts, "Dear contributor," might as well start off, "Dear chump," and so came to relish any little personal dash on these printed pink slips. They were few and far between, but when they came, they never failed to lighten my day and put a smile on my face. In the spring of my senior year at Lisbon High, 1966 this would have been, I got a scribbled comment that changed the way I rewrote my fiction once and forever. Jotted below the machine-generated signature of the editor was this motte: "Not bad, but puffy. You need to revise for length. Formula, second draft equal first draft minus 10%. Good luck." I wish I could remember who wrote that note. Algis Budrys, perhaps. Whoever it was did me a hell of a favor. I copied the formula out on a piece of shirt cardboard and taped it to the wall beside my typewriter. Good things started to happen for me shortly after. There was no sudden golden flood of magazine sales, but the number of personal notes on the rejection slips went up fast. I even got one from Durant Imboden, the fiction editor at Playboy. That communique almost stopped my heart. Playboy paid $2,000 and up for short stories, and $2,000 was a quarter of what my mother made each year in her housekeeping job at Pineland Training Center. The rewrite formula probably wasn't the only reason I started to get some results. I suspect another was that it was just my time coming around at last, sort of like Yeats's Rough Beast. Still, the formula was surely part of it. Before the formula, if I produced a story that was 4,000 words or so in first draft, it was apt to be 5,000 in second. Some writers are taker-outers. I'm afraid I've always been a natural putter-inner. After the formula, that changed. Even today, I will aim for a second draft length of 3,600 words if the first draft of a story ran 4,000. And if the first draft of a novel runs 350,000 words, I'll try my damnedest to produce a second draft of no more than 315,000, 300 if possible. Usually, it is possible. What the formula taught me is that every story and novel is collapsible to some degree. If you can't get out 10% of it while retaining the basic story and flavor, you're not trying very hard. The effect of judicious cutting is immediate and often amazing. Literary Viagra. You'll feel it, and your IR will, too. Backstory is all the stuff that happened before your tale began, but which has an impact on the front story. Backstory helps define character and establish motivation. I think it's important to get the backstory in as quickly as possible, but it's also important to do it with some grace. As an example of what's not graceful, consider this line of dialogue. "Hello, ex-wife," Tom said to Doris as she entered the room. Now, it may be important to the story that Tom and Doris are divorced, but there has to be a better way to do it than the above, which is about as graceful as an axe murder. Here is one suggestion. "Hi, Doris," Tom said. His voice sounded natural enough, to his own ears at least, but the fingers of his right hand crept to the place where his wedding ring had been until 6 months ago. Still no Pulitzer winner, and quite a bit longer than "Hello, ex-wife," but it's not all about speed, as I've already tried to point out. And if you think it's all about information, you ought to give up fiction and get a job writing instruction manuals. Dilbert's cubicle awaits. You've probably heard the phrase in medias res, which means into the midst of things. This technique is an ancient and honorable one, but I don't like it. In medias res necessitates flashbacks, which strike me as boring and sort of corny. They always make me think of those movies from the 40s and 50s where the picture gets all swimmy, the voice gets all echoey, and suddenly it's 16 months ago and the mud-splashed convict we just saw trying to outrun the bloodhounds is an up-and-coming young lawyer who hasn't yet been framed for the murder of the crooked police chief. As a reader, I'm a lot more interested in what's going to happen than what already did. Yes, there are brilliant novels that run counter to this preference, or maybe it's a prejudice. Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier for one, A Dark Adapted Eye by Barbara Vine for another. But I like to start at square one, dead even with the writer. I'm an A to Z man. Serve me the appetizer first and give me dessert if I eat my veggies. Even when you tell your story in this straightforward manner, you'll discover you can't escape at least some backstory. In a very real sense, every life is in medias res. If you introduce a 40-year-old man as your main character on page one of your novel, and if the action begins as a result of some brand new person or situations exploding onto the stage of this fellow's life, a road accident, let's say, or doing a favor for a beautiful woman who keeps looking sexily back over her shoulder. Did you notice the awful adverb in this sentence, which I could not bring myself to kill? You'll still have to deal with the first 40 years of the guy's life at some point. How much and how well you deal with those years will have a lot to do with the level of success your story achieves, with whether readers think of it as a good read or a big fat bore. Probably J.K. Rowling, author of the Harry Potter stories, is the current champ when it comes to backstory. You could do worse than read these, noting how effortlessly each new book recaps what has gone before. Also, the Harry Potter novels are just fun, pure story from beginning to end. Your ideal reader can be of tremendous help when it comes to figuring out how well you did with the backstory and how much you should add or subtract on your next draft. You need to listen very carefully to the things IR didn't understand and then ask yourself if you understand them. If you do and just didn't put those parts across, your job on the second draft is to clarify. If you don't, if the parts of the backstory your ideal reader queried are hazy to you as well, then you need to think a lot more carefully about the past events that cast a light on your character's present behavior. You also need to pay close attention to those things in the backstory that bored your ideal reader. In Bag of Bones, for instance, main character Mike Noonan is a 40-ish writer who, as the book opens, has just lost his wife to a brain aneurysm. We start on the day of her death, but there's still a hell of a lot of backstory here, much more than I usually have in my fiction. This includes Mike's first job as a newspaper reporter, the sale of his first novel, his relations with his late wife's sprawling family, his publishing history, and especially the matter of their summer home in Western Maine, how they came to buy it, and some of its pre-Mike and Johanna history. Tabitha, my IR, read all this with apparent enjoyment, but there was also a 2- or 3-page section about Mike's community service work in the year after his wife dies, a year in which his grief is magnified by a severe case of writer's block. Tabby didn't like the community service stuff. "Who cares?" she asked me. "I want to know more about his bad dreams, not how he ran for city council in order to help get the homeless alcoholics off the street." "Yeah, but he's got writer's block," I said. When a novelist is challenged on something he likes, one of his darlings, the first two words out of his mouth are almost always, "Yeah, but." This block goes on for a year, maybe more. He has to do something in all that time, doesn't he? "I guess so," Tabby said, "but you don't have to bore me with it, do you?" Ouch. Game, set, and match. Like most good IRs, Tabby can be ruthless when she's right. I cut down Mike's charitable contributions and community functions from 2 pages to 2 paragraphs. It turned out that Tabby was right. As soon as I saw it in print, I knew. 3 million people or so have read Bag of Bones. I've gotten at least 4,000 letters concerning it, and so far not a single one has said, "Hey, Turkey, what was Mike doing for community service work during the year he couldn't write?" The most important things to remember about backstory are that A, everyone has a history, and B, most of it isn't very interesting. Stick to the parts that are, and don't get carried away with the rest. Long life stories are best received in bars, and only then, an hour or so before closing time, and if you are buying. We need to talk a bit about research, which is a specialized kind of backstory. And please, if you do need to do research because parts of your story deal with things about which you know little or nothing, remember that word back. That's where research belongs, as far in the background and the backstory as you can get it. You may be entranced with what you're learning about flesh-eating bacteria, the sewer system of New York, or the IQ potential of collie pups, but your readers are probably going to care a lot more about your characters and your story. Exceptions to the rule? Sure, aren't there always? There have been very successful writers, Arthur Haley and James Michener are the first ones that come to my mind, whose novels rely heavily on fact and research. Haley's are barely disguised manuals about how things work, banks, airports, hotels, and Michener's are combination travelogues, geography lessons, and history texts. Other popular writers, like Tom Clancy and Patricia Cornwell, are more story-oriented but still deliver large, and sometimes hard to digest, dollops of factual information along with the melodrama. I sometimes think that these writers appeal to a large segment of the reading population who feel that fiction is somehow immoral, a low taste, which can only be justified by saying, well, yes, I do read, fill in author's name here, but only on airplanes and in hotel rooms that don't have CNN. Also, I learned a great deal about, fill in appropriate subject here. For every successful writer of the factoid type, however, there are 100, perhaps even 1,000, wannabes, some published, most not. On the whole, I think story belongs in front, but some research is inevitable. You shirk it at your peril. In the spring of 1999, I drove from Florida, where my wife and I had wintered, back to Maine. My second day on the road, I stopped for gas at a little station just off the Pennsylvania Turnpike, one of those amusingly antique places where a fellow still comes out, pumps your gas, and asks you how you're doing and who you like in the NCAA tournament. I told this one I was doing fine and like Duke in the tournament. Then I went around back to use the men's room. There was a brawling stream full of snowmelt beyond the station, and when I came out of the men's, I walked a little way down the slope, which was littered with cast-off tire rims and engine parts, for a closer look at the water. There were still patches of snow on the ground. I slipped on one and started to slide down the embankment. I grabbed a piece of someone's old engine block and stopped myself before I got fairly started, but I realized as I got up that if I'd fallen just right, I could have slid all the way down into that stream and been swept away. I found myself wondering, had that happened, how long it would have taken the gas station attendant to call the state police if my car, a brand new Lincoln Navigator, just continued to stand there in front of the pumps. By the time I got back on the turnpike again, I had two things, a wet ass from my fall behind the mobile station and a great idea for a story. In it, a mysterious man in a black coat, likely not a human being at all, but some creature inexpertly disguised to look like one, abandons his vehicle in front of a small gas station in rural Pennsylvania. The vehicle looks like an old Buick Special from the late 50s, but it's no more a Buick than the guy in the black coat was a human being. The vehicle falls into the hands of some state police officers working out of a fictional barracks in western Pennsylvania. 20 years or so later, these cops tell the story of the Buick to the grief-stricken son of a state policeman who has been killed in the line of duty. It was a grand idea and has developed into a strong novel about how we hand down our knowledge and our secrets. It's also a grim and frightening story about an alien piece of machinery that sometimes reaches out and swallows people whole. Of course, there were a few minor problems. The fact that I knew absolutely zilch about the Pennsylvania State Police, for one thing. But I didn't let any of that bother me. I simply made up the stuff I didn't know. I could do that because I was writing with the door shut, writing only for myself and the ideal reader in my mind. My mental version of Tabby is rarely as prickly as my real-life wife can be. In my daydreams, she usually applauds and urges me ever onward with shining eyes. One of my most memorable sessions took place in a fourth-floor room of Boston's Elliott Hotel. Me sitting at the desk by the window, writing about an autopsy on an alien bat creature, while the Boston Marathon flowed exuberantly by just below me, and rooftop boomboxes blasted out dirty water by the Standells. There were 1,000 people down there below me in the streets, but not a single one in my room to be a party pooper and tell me I got this detail wrong or the cops don't do things that way in western Pennsylvania, so nyah, nyah, nyah. The novel, it's called From a Buick 8, has been set aside in a desk drawer since late May of 1999 when the first draft was finished. Work on it has been delayed by circumstances beyond my control, but eventually I hope and expect to spend a couple of weeks in western Pennsylvania, where I've been given conditional permission to do some ride-alongs with the state police. The condition, which seems eminently reasonable to me, was that I not make them look like meanies, maniacs, or idiots. Once I've done that, I should be able to correct the worst of my howlers and add some really nice detail work. Not much, though. Research is backstory, and the key word in backstory is back. The tale I have to tell in Buick 8 has to do with monsters and secrets. It is not a story about police procedure in western Pennsylvania. What I'm looking for is nothing but a touch of verisimilitude, like the handful of spices you chuck into a good spaghetti sauce to really finish her off. That sense of reality is important in any work of fiction, but I think it is particularly important in a story dealing with the abnormal or paranormal. Also, enough details, always assuming they are the correct ones, can stem the tide of letters from picky-ass readers who apparently live to tell writers that they messed up. The tone of these letters is unvaryingly gleeful. When you step away from the write-what-you-know rule, research becomes inevitable, and it can add a lot to your story. Just don't end up with the tail wagging the dog. Remember that you are writing a novel, not a research paper. The story always comes first. I think even James Michener and Arthur Haley would have agreed with that.